Christopher Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for the Art Hop visitor last night here in our building who asked, are you Paul Leffler? I don't know why this happens. We don't look like each other, and yet I think people see a tall male with dark hair, although Paul has, you know, Paul doesn't have the silver thing going. And yet I get asked all the time. I wonder if Paul gets asked, are you Christopher Gabriel? I'm sure he doesn't. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your two-hour Friday morning tour begins right now. 4 minutes, 47 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Delighted to be with you. Cool morning here in the Central Valley, just as I like it. It'll get a little bit warmer later on. Technical director, producer, the program, hockey guy, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us moving in the right direction. On the program today, our Friday encore, Ben Ross from NBC Sports California. He'll be returning at 7:35. Well, it's not really returning. It's our conversation from yesterday. Good stuff on the Oakland A's. He does a great job covering the A's, and you'll hear that again if you missed it yesterday, and a lot of our morning audience often does. 8:05, we're talking Jose Ramirez with my man, Derek X. Jose's got a big fight coming up, and this is going to be a good one. This is going to be a good one. Maurice Hooker is going to be fighting. It's going to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I believe it's going to be in Arlington. He is 26-0, and he's going to be fighting Jose Ramirez. I believe it's going to be a unification bout. So Derek is here to give us all the details on that. 8:35, our weekly visit with Nick Shager. Last night in the National Hockey League, I'm surprised, I don't know about you, Russ, I'm surprised that Boston lost at home last night, 2-1 to the Blues. I don't like either team, doesn't really matter, but I've been rooting for Boston in this just because I like the Blues. I dislike the Blues more. But Blues will be going home, Game 6, a chance to win their first Stanley Cup. Of course, you know the story with the Blues. They came into the league in 1967, and of the five teams in the league that came in from 1967, Flyers, Penguins, Kings, and Stars, used to be the North Stars. The others have all won a Stanley Cup. The Blues have not. I guess we can call their fans long-suffering, and they have a chance to wrap this thing up. My gut tells me that they're going to do it. Just seems like it's been that kind of playoff run for that team. So, this game three the other night in Oracle Arena, you had a game that, of course, Kevin Durant wasn't playing, Klay Thompson wasn't playing, Kevon Looney wasn't playing, and that really wasn't the big story. It wasn't a big story. What a great night the Raptors had. They win the game in double figures, chance to take a real control of the series tonight against the Warriors in Oracle. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the Warriors are going to win tonight. I think the Warriors are going to win in double figures, to be honest with you. But Klay should be playing tonight. Kevin Durant will not be playing. But those various storylines were not the story of the game. Those weren't the things that went viral after the game. What you had going viral was Mark Stevens. We talked about yesterday a little bit, an investor for the Warriors, someone who spent, I think the number that I saw, hundreds of millions that he invested in the team. He's a small share, he's a minority share owner of the Golden State Warriors. And you had him shoving Kyle Lowry, and of course you know the story since then, that he has been suspended for 1 year from any and all NBA activities, $500,000 fine. And the thought is, I talked with Coach Q about this, and also some of you, the thought is that they're going to force him to sell his share of the team. Maybe it'll be done publicly, maybe it'll be done quietly. The irony is, with the current value of the Golden State Warriors, if he is forced to sell, he will make about, what I saw from Forbes, something on the order of 3 to 4 times what his investment was. So, he won't have the title on his business card, whatever it says, that he is an owner of the, a small portion owner of the Warriors. I don't know how that works out if you own 5%, 10%, 20% of the team, whatever else. If you're not Joe Lacob, I don't know how that reads on your business card or on your letterhead or on your email signatures, but he won't have that. But I don't think he'll care. But that really wasn't the biggest story. The biggest story was really the most ridiculous story that really isn't so ridiculous when you start to look a little deeper. You had Jay-Z and Beyonce sitting at half court next to Nicole Curran, who is the wife of Warriors owner Joe Lacob. And I know that most of you know this, that those two, Jay-Z and Beyonce, I don't listen to any of their music, certainly know who they are, but they've been guests on many occasions of Joe Lacob and Nicole Curran right there at half court. And what you saw was video. You saw about 10 seconds or 12 seconds of video of Jay-Z and Beyonce looking out on the court and kind of waving with both hands to somebody, smiling at somebody. I don't know if it was a player or maybe somebody across the court. Big smiles on their faces. And you see Nicole Curran lean over, and she's trying to say something to Jay-Z. And so she's leaning just a little bit in front of Beyonce. And the internet went wild. They went crazy. Because the thought was, how dare you disrespect Beyonce like that? Okay, you're in an arena. You're at half court. There's already noise in the arena, and so it's not easy to hear. So she's leaning across. She's not leaning across the Queen of England. This isn't a world leader. This isn't the President of the United States. This isn't the Prime Minister of Canada. It's Beyonce. I know she's a big star. I get it. She's a powerful woman. I get all that. But she's Beyonce. The outcry over this is unbelievable. But where it was fueled even more is that there's no way to know what she's thinking, but her face goes a little sour. It could be anything. You know, a lot of people's resting look, they look like they're glaring, or they look like they're disinterested in what you might be talking about. We all have friends who you might at one point be thinking, or you might even say to them, "What? Everything okay?" And then they'll suddenly light up and go, "Yeah, sure, what's wrong?" But it's just kind of the way they look. But you saw her eyes dart to the left a little bit because, I watched this. I watched this a number of times for the reason that I'm going to get to, which you probably know already. And then she adjusts herself in her seat, and it looks like, if you want to interpret it this way, it looks like she takes her left shoulder and sort of bumps Nicole Curran, kind of like to say, don't you be talking to my man over here. That's the way one big group, and I mean a big group, probably millions, because she has, I believe she has 15 million followers. Beyonce has 15 million followers, and she follows like 30 on Twitter. Big group interpreted it that way. Another way to interpret it is that none of that was going on. That she was done waving at somebody across the court. The woman to her left, Nicole Curran, who she certainly knows who she is saying something to Jay-Z, and she was just adjusting herself in her seat, and that's that. Well, here's what Ramona Shelburne, who is, Ramona Shelburne is, a terrific reporter with ESPN. She's a senior writer for ESPN.com, and this is how she reported it, because She talked to Nicole Curran. So this is what Ramona Shelburne said. Just spoke to Nicole. This is on Twitter. Just spoke to Nicole Curran, the wife of Warriors owner Joe Lacob, about the, and she put it in quotes, the incident. with Beyonce last night. She was in tears. She said she had been getting death threats on social media all night. This morning, she disabled her Instagram account just to make it stop. Curran said she had no idea anything was even amiss until she got home and started seeing texts from friends and checked her social media. She invited Jay-Z and Beyonce to the game. She's invited them to the game 3 or 4 times before. Last night, she said she asked if they wanted drinks. Beyonce asked for water. Curran says Jay-Z asked for a vodka soda. She asked if he wanted lime with that. But it was loud on Oracle, and she couldn't hear, so she leaned over. That's where the photos of Beyonce looking askance at her came from. Curran says she then went to get them those drinks, and she, and in quotes here, these are Nicole Curran's words, there was no hostility. I was trying to be a good hostess. I've never experienced cyberbullying like this. I can't believe our players go through this, that kids go through this. And when you understand that this is a person who was receiving death threats, and it was well publicized, and you've heard it all, it's just astounding to me that this is where we're at, that legions, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Beyonce fans attacking this woman because of what? Because she leaned over at a basketball game to see if he wanted a lime, if Jay-Z wanted some lime in his vodka and soda. And these fans of hers, you know, sticking up for their queen, for Beyonce. Okay, Beyonce couldn't care less about any of them. I'm not saying that the woman doesn't appreciate that she has fans and that she has people buying her music and downloading her music. Of course she does. But she's got 15 million followers on Twitter. 15 million. Think about that for a second. I took a peek at her Twitter. She's following 10 people, and she has tweeted 12 times. She put a tweet up on April 17. I guess it's about a film or a TV show, or no, it's about an album. Before that, the last time she tweeted before that, was June 16th of last year. So you got fans who are attacking a woman who has invited Beyonce and Jay-Z to the game multiple times, to a Warriors game multiple times. She's asking what they want to drink. She's, oh, okay, you want a lime? And you have fans that have no idea what's gone on or what's been said or what body language means. And they're not, they somehow think they're coming to her support. I'll say it again. Beyonce doesn't care. She couldn't care less about the what do they call the beehive or whatever it is. And listen, I'm not knocking Beyonce. I'm knocking the fans. Who sends death threats on social media because they see someone leaning across their favorite singer? That's just, this is where we're at now. That's just dumb. And it's a little scary. It's a little scary. And it has taken this long for Beyonce's publicist to actually come out and condemn the fans for doing that. She did that, I believe, late last night. I guess the question I have is, where is Beyonce in all this? When you have death threats involved, and you're talking about a basketball game. She and Jay-Z are at a basketball game. They're next to the owner and his wife. She's going to get them drinks. They don't like her leaning over. Just crazy. This is the dark side of social media. This is where we are at now in 2019. And so I'm sure that Beyonce's thinking, you know, when this was made apparent to her, I want to believe that she had to think, this is crazy. This is nuts. Irrespective of even worst case scenario, even if she didn't like her leaning across her, she was invading her personal space, didn't like her talking to Jay-Z, you throw all that into the mix, I am sure as someone who is a smart, very strong, very successful woman in the business world and in the performing world, that she, the last thing she wanted to hear are people lining up giving death threats to the woman who was sitting on her left, who happens to be the wife of the owner of the Golden State Warriors. I just don't get it. I just don't get it at all. Glad you're hanging out with us. It's Friday morning. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Can we talk some basketball now? Can we just stop? I know I'm the one doing it, but no more Beyonce, no more Jay-Z, no more Mark Stevens. Let's talk a little basketball. Because I've talked about this week with Tony D a couple of times, and if you listen to our segments together on Monday or on Wednesday, you've definitely dialed into the fact that we've talked about Kawhi Leonard, we've talked about Kevin Durant. And I have to tell you, and I raised this point the other day, and I'm certainly not the only one out there raising this, but I have serious doubts that Kawhi Leonard is going to leave Toronto. And you see what he's done on this team. And because of Kawhi Leonard, what you've seen are guys who have been there, the guys who have been there prior to his arrival, you're seeing their skill level get to the ceiling and even burst through it. You're seeing guys playing the game of basketball at a level that they hadn't played before. And that's because of Kawhi Leonard. He has helped them get that ability to where it could be and now is. And if I'm Kawhi Leonard, put yourself in his shoes for a second. And you're looking at the teams that have been talked about. You're looking at the Knicks and the Nets. You're looking at the Lakers and the Clippers. And there's some other ones out there. But those are the prime contenders. If you are standing in the shoes of Kawhi Leonard and you see the team that you have, and you have a coach in Nick Nurse who is a wonderful basketball mind, he came out of nowhere in terms of his ability to match the adjustments that are being made by Steve Kerr, before that, Brett Brown, and so on. He's with a coach, though, that has a temperament that is right in the wheelhouse for a Kawhi Leonard. What I'm driving at is this. If you're Kawhi, where do you want to go that you're going to have a better situation? Why would you want to leave a team that is either going to win the NBA championship or they're going to come darn close? At a minimum, they lose in six games. More likely, if they lose, it'll be seven. But where are you going to go that, short of the Golden State Warriors, even if they lose KD, we'll get to KD in a second, where are you going to go that you're going to be with a coach that you're going to like as much or more, and you're going to be with a group of players? I don't care who he gets packaged with, if it was Kyrie Irving or whomever. Anywhere he goes, except if it's the Golden State Warriors, and he's not going to the Golden State Warriors, is a step down. It's a big step down. Anywhere he goes next year, even the Clippers, as good as they would be, he's not going to win an NBA championship with the Clippers next year. He's not going to win it with the Knicks. He's not going to win it with the Nets. And we can assume that. Let me be safe in assuming that. He has a fan base and a city, a province, and a country that loves him. And if they win the NBA championship, it goes without saying that he will be, if not on the same mantle with the great players that have ever played in a Toronto Maple Leaf sweater, he'll be just off to the left or right of them. And there's no question about it. Why would you give that up? Why would you want to leave? Because New York and L.A. are more glamorous? Toronto is a hell of a city. It's a great city. Everything you could want in the way of entertainment. He doesn't strike me as a guy who's hitting the clubs. Great restaurants. It's a clean city. It's a friendly city. Yeah, they have problems like everywhere else. But it's a city that's going to leave him alone. Their media is pretty aggressive there. But you come there and win an NBA championship, it's already enough. The shot that he made to beat Philadelphia, that hit legendary status. I don't think he's going to leave. I hinted at that a little bit earlier this week with Tony. Now I really don't believe he's going to leave. The question really for me is, what is Kevin Durant going to do? Because we keep talking about teams that he's looking at. And I know that he's got a different personality makeup, at least from a distance, best that we can see. He's a quiet guy like Kawhi is, but he's far more attuned to what people are saying about him. And he's far more willing to engage somebody sitting in his basement in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who's 17 years old and he doesn't like what he said about him. But think of it this way, just for argument's sake. Anywhere that he's thinking of going, because the teams that have been thrown out there, the three teams primarily that have been thrown out there are the Knicks and Madison Square Garden, the Brooklyn Nets, Barclays Center, LeBron James, Lakers, Staples Center. If he goes to any of those three teams, he's taking not only a step back from the Warriors, he's going to a team that is even less likely to do some damage in the playoffs than the team he came from, the Oklahoma City Thunder. There's no question about it. The Clippers would be the one choice. Staples Center, Doc Rivers, good coach, players coach, some good pieces on that team, no doubt. But his mentality on this is he wants to, or so we believe, is that he wants to have a team that's his team. Are we jumping the gun too fast to say that he's going to leave the Warriors if he doesn't get back on the court, if he doesn't get to play anymore? He's not playing tonight, and I raised the idea the other day, are we just getting messed with a little bit? Coach Q doesn't think so. Tony D doesn't think so. That Steve Kerr is a straight shooter, and I know he is, but this game by game, we're hoping to have him back next game, and then it seems like a matter of hours later we hear, he's out for game two. Oh, he's out for game three. Okay, he's out for game four. Well, it's gotten to the point of being ridiculous. That's the reason that I raised the idea of, do they have an idea he's just not going to come back? I'm still holding out hope that he comes back. He's not going to be back tonight. I don't think he's going to be back for a game five. A game six would be an elimination game for one team or the other. Elimination game. Somebody's potentially winning the NBA championship that night. And if it's the Warriors, what a return that would be for him, would it not? And we've learned, you know, I've said all along that the Warriors aren't better or worse with Durant. Without Durant, they're different. They're obviously not better, and they had a great run without him. But I think this run against Toronto, which is clearly the best team they've played in the playoffs. Remember a few weeks ago, all we were hearing is that the Houston series with the Warriors, that was going to be essentially the NBA final. That would be the toughest run they'd have. But nobody knew what was going to happen with injuries. And I think we've seen that Toronto is every bit as good as we thought they were when you look at what they did in the regular season. We tend to look at Houston and see what James Harden would do night after night after night and the ability that he has to drop 50 without, you know, breaking a sweat and just giving the mantle to Houston saying they're the best team the Warriors are going to play. Clearly that's not been the case. Obviously it's been different because Durant's not been in, but what we've seen is how good a team this Toronto team really is. You know, if you want to look at it a different way, they've beaten the Warriors 4 out of 5 games this year. In the last four or five years, show me a team that's beaten them 4 out of 5. The only thing you can come close to is the year the Cavaliers won 3 in a row after being down 3-1. I mean, they swept them, but this Toronto team swept them in the regular season both games, and they've won 2 of 3 so far now. So I don't know. My lean is still that Kevin Durant's going to leave because his need to have his own team seems to have been more the driving force than anything else. But I'm getting more convinced, if not completely convinced, that Kawhi Leonard is going to stay in Toronto, win or lose in this championship series. Coming up, our Friday encore, it is our friend Ben Ross, who covers the Oakland Athletics for NBC Sports California. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Ben Ross is someone I wanted to get on the program a long time, and we had a lot of 30-minute car wash editions of the program because of the Giants. But finally, we had some space, and his schedule allows it. He covers the A's for the for NBC Sports up in the Bay Area. There's a lot of different titles there. You have the A's on NBC Sports California. You have NBC Sports Authentic. His business card must be massive. Ben Ross joins me right now. How are you, my friend?
Hey, doing well. Yeah, my business card is gigantic. A lot of titles on there.
A lot of titles. Hey, maybe the best starting point is this. So the A's on this date last year were 31-30. Today they are 30-31. Ben, coming off a 97-win season, a wild card game appearance, was there a reasonable expectation that they would be a little better than they are, or maybe a lot better than they are right now?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that it's a little bit disappointing where they're at. As you noted, they were, you know, kind of off to a slow start as well last year before they really took off. And, you know, for A's fans who have followed the team for a while, I'm sure they're pretty aware that this is a team that, you know, a lot of the time will get off to slow starts and really get going in the second half. But certainly there were some high expectations this year, and I think the team has been a little up and down, a little inconsistent. So, you know, all things considered, they're still right there around 500. They're still in the wild card race, even if they've fallen 11 games behind Houston at this point. But I think that, you know, people maybe expected a little bit more of them, but still 100 games to go and a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a good point, Ben. And, you know, one of the themes on this program we always talk about, and boy, you know this as well as anyone, is people in our side of the business of sports, there's a lot of overreaction. You know, there's folks, friends of mine in Toronto that think the series is over with the Warriors. It's like, come on, it's three games. Just everybody calm down and relax. In baseball, sometimes you look at an individual game, and it would be very easy to say, ooh, this game, maybe this is going to be a game where we look back on and say it really sent us in the wrong direction, or it really launched us. And obviously I'm thinking about last night's game. 7-1 lead, so you have Shohei Ohtani hits a three-run homer in the fourth. Suddenly, you know, one thing leads to another. It's the A's are down 8-7. Then they go up 9-8. I'm condensing this. Melvin walks Trout, doesn't want to get beat by Trout. Ohtani is next up. Of course, he walks. Game's tied. Then the A's lose in the bottom of the ninth because of a Robbie Grossman misplay. When you see a game like that for a team right now that, yeah, they're off to a little bit of a slower start, is it harder to put that in the rearview mirror, or is it a game that, because, you know, you're around these guys, that has the potential to linger and be a dark cloud for a bit?
Well, first of all, I want to say that's a nice job by you right there of recapping that game because, yeah, a lot went on last night, no question about it. But, you know, the one thing about this team is they've proven to be pretty resilient the last couple of years, even though they're young and, you know, fairly inexperienced at a lot of their positions. They don't seem to let these types of things bother them. I mean, looking at this year, unfortunately, they've already had a few games kind of like last night where they've blown big leads, something we really didn't see last year. But they are able to bounce back. So, you know, they've been inconsistent, but the one thing I will say about them is they've shown the ability to put these things behind them quickly. And so I don't expect this to linger. At the same time, you don't want to have too many of these types of losses because, of course, at the end of the year, you don't want to be looking back and, you know, miss the playoffs by a couple of games and be able to point to a couple of these types of games they probably should have won.
No question. My guest is Ben Ross. You can find him on Twitter at Ben Ross Tweets. Covers the A's for NBC Sports up in the Bay Area. Also a Berkeley grad. I won't hold it against him, and hopefully he won't hold it against me that I'm from SC. A couple of Pac-12 guys here. You know, just a sidebar for you, Ben. I thought there was an interesting sort of best of times, worst of times last night that was a bit of a metaphor for the entire season so far, the 60-plus games for the A's, because you had the Robbie Grossman misplay in left field, but then you had the Matt Olson infield double. And I mean,
right.
You know, that was, and boy, doesn't that show, how many times have we watched guys a play like that and they immediately give up on it running down the line? And Olson, man, he turned on the Jets just knowing there's always a chance that something can go wrong. Boy, that has to be one that everybody on that team in that dugout saying, nice job, man.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's something where you show, you know, young baseball players, see, you got to hustle on every play because, yeah, as you said, sometimes you'll see in the big leagues guys will pop up and really not run it out. To Matt Olson's credit, he busted his tail even though it was a pop-up right on the infield. And, you know, keep in mind, I think he was in an 0-for-18 slump heading into that at-bat. And still, he hustled and ended up on second base, and he was rewarded when that thing dropped in with a double that went about 14 feet.
That's a great point. And it's a great point that you made about you take that play. Every little league manager, everyone just says, hey, kids, just take a look at this play. This is how I want you to play. That's a great point. When the A's won their 10 in a row and you had that game in the middle there, I think it was the Tigers that got suspended, that's going to be concluded at some point the rest of the year, isn't it? Isn't it at some point?
Yeah, they're going to pick that one up. Not till September.
Okay.
So the Tigers come to Oakland, I believe it's September 6th. And they'll finish that game then.
Okay, so around that game, the A's won 10 in a row. I mean, they were leading SportsCenter a couple of nights, which was great. So I guess my thought here is that what this team can be, or in your best estimation, Ben, was it more of an aberration? I mean, obviously everything was going right. They were averaging over 7 runs a game in that stretch, which was helped a little bit by that 17-3 win over the Tigers. Since that 10-game streak, they've averaged just over 4. Are they closer to that? Are they closer to this? Or are we going to find somewhere in the middle that will be the Oakland A's of the 2019 season?
Boy, that's a great question. And I think that's what, you know, all A's fans are kind of waiting to see. I like to think that that's what they're capable of. I mean, they really did show when their offense gets going, it's a deep lineup. I mean, 1 through 9, these guys can hit. They can hit for power. You look at Josh Fegley, the catcher, who's having an unbelievable year. He's been hitting 9th all year. He's got 7 home runs and 33 RBIs. I think he's near the top of the league as far as runs batted in for catchers. And he's in the 9 hole. And then you look at a guy like Ramon Laureano, who right now has been hitting 7th. He's on a tear. And keep in mind, you know, Chris Davis has been hurt. He really hasn't been the Chris Davis we've expected to see over the past few years. If he ever gets going and starts getting his power bat going as well, I mean, this lineup is really dangerous. So I think they are capable of that. I think the one thing that's been sort of disappointing this year has been the bullpen. And as I mentioned before, they've lost some games this year that they just would not have lost last year. Last year, I think they were undefeated for most of the season when they led after 7 innings. This year, it's been a completely different story. And so you can point to about 5 or 6 games already that they probably had in the bag and should have won. And I think their record would probably look a lot different had they won those games.
Well, it's like you're in the studio looking at my notes, because that's exactly where I wanted to go, Ben. I mean, there's no question, because I was looking at – I was really trying to break down the A's, knowing that you were coming, and to see kind of, you know, what's been leading them to where they're at. And you look at their hitting, and it's not bad. They're about middle of the pack of the American League. You mentioned Chris Davis, you know, needs to get back and being fully healthy and what have you. Pitching has been solid, but yeah, the blown saves. I think they've blown 50% of their save opportunities. That will kill any. Mm-hmm. That will kill any team. Is this something that Melvin thinks is going to be solvable with who's in there, or do you see them? Do they need to get closer and have a viable chance to getting in the playoffs again, being a wild card team, where maybe they try to address that?
Well, I think if they're going to be in the playoff race again, their bullpen is going to have to come around. And to be honest, I think it will. You know, it's interesting when you look at their pen right now. It's sort of the big name guys that have been struggling, the guys that you expected to be lights out. You know, Blake Treinen last year, the closer, had a historic season. I mean, he had an ERA under 1 at the end of last year. He did look pretty good his last time out, which was nice to see, but he's had his struggles this year. Then you look at a guy like Lou Trevino, who was a rookie last season, and he was pretty dominant as well as a seventh or eighth inning type guy. He's had his struggles. I think he's lost his he's taken the loss in his last four appearances, including last night, although last night maybe not entirely his fault with the misplay out in left field. But those are certainly guys that I think they're going to need more from, and they'll probably get. The other kind of disappointment in the pen has been Joaquin Soria, who was sort of their big free agent signing this offseason. They gave him 2 years, $15 million to be, you know, a lights-out setup man. And his ERA right now is over five. So I think, you know, if those three guys can get going, because they have had other guys in the bullpen step up. You look at Liam Hendricks having a really nice year. Yusmeiro Petit has been really good. Ryan Buchter, last night notwithstanding, has been really good his last few weeks. So I think the potential is definitely there in the bullpen. It's just a matter of these guys executing.
So then taking your point, by the way, my guest, folks, Ben Ross, covers the A's for NBC Sports California, does a little play-by-play, does a little bit of everything, covering them, does a great job. You can find him on Twitter at Ben Ross Tweets. Matt Chapman, he's had a really strong year so far, needs a little help. Guys having good years like Marcus Semien. You mentioned Chris Davis. Who does Bob Melvin believe needs to step up his game a little bit more, or one of several people for that part of the ball club to really get them back into a better groove where they're leaning a little bit more to the team offensively that we saw in that 10-game winning streak?
Well, I think it certainly starts with Chris Davis, who you mentioned. I mean, he got off to a terrific start this year. I think he had 10 home runs in about the first month of the season before he kind of started dealing with the injury to his hip and slumping a little bit. So, you know, he is still the guy that makes that offense go, hitting in that four spot. I mean, he's just such a threat. He's hit for 40 or more home runs the last 3 years. Still has 12, even though he's kind of been slumping and dealing with the injury the last month. So I think he's the guy where it certainly starts. Another guy who had a big year last year, who I think we'll see get going a little more, is Stephen Piscotty. You know, that's a guy that Bob Melvin often sort of says is the wild card and kind of the undervalued guy in that lineup. He hits right in the middle as well, typically fifth or sixth. And, you know, he's a guy last year who hit more than 20 home runs and, you know, he can do a little bit of everything in that lineup. So I think he's another guy who we'll see get going a little bit more in the second half. And then certainly Matt Olson is another big bat, really the big left-handed bat in the lineup. And he missed quite a bit of time to start the year. I think it was around 50 games, you know, broke his hand in the second game of the season in Japan. He has shown some power since he's come back, which is a good thing. This is a guy who A's fans probably remember a couple of years ago when he came onto the scene late as a rookie. He was hitting home runs at a historic pace. So that's a guy who also provides a lot of power in the middle of the lineup. So I think you look at those three guys, and then you reference Matt Chapman, who's probably having the best year all around of the A's and figures to be an all-star this year. Those guys certainly key the offense.
Ben, I want to pivot a little bit here. I was doing a little looking around, and quite honestly, I couldn't believe the amount of articles that were some version of, well, what's wrong with the A's? Is it the team? Is it the crowds? Is it the ballpark? And yet, you know, we're an affiliate for the A's here at 940 ESPN, and it's an organization that can be argued every day of summer makes a tremendous effort in marketing. We got this package from the front office or from the marketing department that was great. I mean, I would be willing to bet that three quarters of Major League Baseball would be envious of the kind of marketing that they put together. So as you look at this and you look beyond the field, beyond the results that are on the field, you see the crowds, you see what the team is doing in advertising, what have you. How are you feeling about the way they're going? Because they're competing against, it's like the White Sox in Chicago. No matter what they do, they're going up against the Cubs. Same with the Mets in New York. You know this. And the A's,
right,
for all that they've won over the years, and they've won considerably, they're still fighting that battle with the team across the bay with the beautiful park. Where are the A's in the bigger picture right now up in the Bay Area?
Man, that's a great question. And I think we could probably do an entire show on that. No, certainly I think they've done a much better job. I give a lot of credit to the new team president, Dave Cavill, who took over a couple of years ago as far as the marketing side of things and really trying to cater to fans. Obviously, he's been really involved in the new trying to get the new ballpark over at Howard Terminal near Dak London Square. And, you know, still some obstacles to go before they get that deal officially done. But he's, you know, really working hard with that. But in the meantime, I've got to give him a lot of credit just for what they've even done at the Coliseum. I mean, each year they've added more features. They added a kid zone this year. They added the treehouse, which is kind of a cool bar out in left field. And they've got the new kind of ticket program, the way they do season tickets with their all access. It's a very forward-thinking organization, and so I do give them a lot of credit there because they know that they've got some limitations, as you mentioned, competing against a team like the Giants. And, you know, we kind of forget because the Giants have struggled the last few years, but they've still won three World Series this decade. And so that's kind of tough to go up against, especially as you referenced their nice new ballpark. I guess it's not that new anymore at Oracle. But, yeah, it's definitely a complicated thing. I think the A's have certainly lost some of their fans over the years based on some of the moves that they've made, some of the rumors of the team leaving Oakland in the past. And, you know, when you see what they've done as far as personnel, getting rid of a lot of fan favorites and maybe not being able to compete financially with a lot of teams, it's a complicated situation up here. But I think the fans are starting to realize that this is a fun team to watch. I mean, it's a young team, but there is a ton of talent. You look at guys like Matt Chapman, who's a budding superstar, Chris Davis, the reigning home run champion, Ramon Laureano, one of the most exciting guys in the game out in center field, just defensively and with his arm. So it's a really fun team, and obviously coming off a great year last year, we'll see if they can kind of repeat that in the second half.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. They really are a fun team to watch. Folks, I'm talking with Ben Ross, who covers the A's for NBC Sports California up in the Bay Area. And I thought the phrase, I wrote it down as you said it because I thought you really nailed it. Forward-thinking organization. They really are. And I would offer you this. My two tours of duty, if you want to call it that, in California, I've lived here a total of just about 12 years. And while I know Giants fans, many of them will claim to the great old days of Candlestick. Candlestick just wasn't a very nice park. I spent more than enough nights in there to know that. And, you know, the Giants didn't have all that great of run until they got into the new park. So both franchises up there were a little bit, you know, behind the eight ball, so to speak. The Giants made their move. I really believe that if the A's do get this park done, and Ben, I think you're kind of leaning in this direction, I think they will get the new park done. That will be such a key, not only for the franchise to stay there, but for the entire area. Do you get the sense that that is the lean, that they're going to get this thing done one way or another?
Boy, I agree with you that it would be huge, and I'm starting to think that they will. You know, when they first announced this plan that they had late last year, it seemed like it might be tough to get done. There were just so many obstacles to getting this new ballpark done over at Howard Terminal. But again, I give credit to Dave Cavill and the whole crew over there. They are making a lot of progress, and it's starting to seem like there's a real chance they can get this done. And if they do, you know, their plan is to open still not till 2023, so, you know, 4 years from now. But if they get it done, I think it really would be huge for the city of Oakland, for the organization. And you look at, again, you look at the talent they have on this team. I think they sort of have that ballpark plan in mind with their personnel. They're hoping, you know, all these young guys they have will hopefully be in their prime when they open that ballpark in 4 years. Guys like Chapman and Olson and Laureano, and then some of the young starting pitching that they have as well. Unfortunately, a lot of them are hurt right now. But, you know, you look to the future. On the field, I think it's a team with a really bright future. And if they can get that ballpark, I think the entire city will really benefit. And I think it also would show the fan. I think a lot of the fans would come back once they see that. The issue I think a lot of fans have is, you know, they've been trying to get a new ballpark for so long that it's almost like Charlie Brown was with Lucy pulling the football out from under them. You know, they're just used to being disappointed, these deals falling through. I think if they ever actually get something officially done and actually start building this stadium, I think a lot of fans would come back to this team.
I can't confirm the fact that I think Charlie Brown's original color scheme was green and gold, but I'm just not sure. Folks, he is Ben Ross. You can find him, and I hope you do, on Twitter and give him a follow, at Ben Ross Tweets. He covers the A's for NBC Sports California. Well, it's a lot of fun, Ben. I'm so glad I finally got you on the program. I hope you'll come back.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks a lot.
Fantastic. Ben Ross, folks. All right, this is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up at about 4 minutes after the hour of 8 a.m., my man Derek X joining me. We're going to talk Jose Ramirez. We're going to talk Maurice Hooker, Andy Ruiz, and that whole fight and the aftermath of that. Lots to talk about. Always like to get my bearings set and going in the right direction with Derek. So he is here. The entourage is here. You know, whenever the guys in boxing, so you have the boxers, they have the entourages. And then the guys who talk about boxing, they have bigger entourages. It's unbelievable. He comes in. There's a dozen people. They're all outside the glass window right here. They're looking inside. They've got their little cameras going. I think some of them are security, too. I'm not really sure. It's a little uncomfortable, but I think we're going to be okay. Glad you are hanging out with us, spending a little bit of time with your Friday morning. Don't forget to also 8:35, Nick Shager, Daily Beast, Variety, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire, giving you his usual great preview of the weekend, as well as maybe there's some things coming up on Amazon or maybe Netflix. You'll hear about it from Nick Shager. And then one more thing at about 8:55. Hour two is next. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, time for your second cup of coffee with me. Begins right now, 3 minutes, 40 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I was wondering if we just would start these, like each hour on a Friday, just saying, and good morning, how are you? Are you enjoying yourself? Have some eggs, some cereal, some bacon, and sit back and enjoy the next. I'd be out of my mind if I did that. I'd be absolutely crazy. People would storm the studio to get them out. Well, some maybe do that anyway. We love talking boxing on this program because I have one guy who comes in and is basically schools me up and keeps me on my toes on everything that's going on in this sport, locally, regionally, and nationally, and he is Derek X, and he joins me right now. Good to see you, my friend.
Good morning, CG. How you doing?
Man, I'm doing great. You look great, as always. Let's just jump right in.
Yes,
so
sir.
You have this fight, Anthony Joshua and mm-hmm. Andy Ruiz Jr., and I'm not making a joke here. I saw Andy Ruiz, and I just thought he's not in great shape. He's probably going to get crushed by Joshua, and I, of course, was completely wrong. It was at, what, a seventh-round stoppage? And I mean, and when I saw the highlights of the fight, I mean, this was no fluke.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. And if you get into the analytics of it, of what Andy Ruiz had done in the past, his record, his only loss was to Joseph Parker for a belt. And he lost it on a decision. Now, Parker was bigger than him. And when they talked to Parker, Parker's like, Joshua better be careful on this. Because if Andy gets inside, he can hit you and it will sting. And that came from a former title holder himself. Joshua ended up taking the belts from Parker. But a lot of people underestimated Andy, and I think even the odds makers. Now, this wasn't epic in the aspects of Buster Douglas, because Buster Douglas was like at minus 2,500 or plus 2,500. Andy was at I think maxed out at a plus 1,100 at Vegas. So there, you know, those were the average Joe betting odds. Anytime you put down some money, you can add an extra zero to it. So Vegas lost a lot of money on that. But Andy had never, ever been knocked down. He gets knocked down in the third round, and people are just going crazy. Okay, Joshua's got this wrapped up. No, he gets back up and knocks Joshua down twice in the same round.
And go ahead, please.
And I think what some people missed on this, too, was in the fourth round, Andy hit him with a shot behind the ear, and that kind of dazed him for the whole rest of the fight, to where the term was used where Joshua may have been a little bit drunk at that time. I don't think he ever got his bearings after that.
Did in your best estimation, Derek, do you think that Joshua, for whatever reason, simply didn't buy in and take him as serious as he should have?
I don't know if he didn't take him as serious as he should have. I don't think he trained properly, because he had to fight down because of the size difference. And Andy got inside, and I don't think he was prepared for that. If Joshua would have kept going what he did in the first rounds of just jabbing and keeping the distance and then peppering him, it would have been a different fight. But he kept allowing Andy to get inside. Andy was fighting his fight.
Doesn't the corner come in play in that?
Yes, okay. It does. Now, I don't know if they were listening or if Joshua was listening, because I've seen that happen before, especially after he knocked him down in the third round. You can see Joshua came at him again thinking, okay, I'm going to finish him off. So I don't think he took him lightly. I don't think he was prepared for Andy's power and for Andy's diligence to get in there and just grind with him. If you look at the punch stats, they were fairly even. Andy was a little bit higher, especially on the power punches. And those are what it take its toll. He got into Joshua's body after rocking his head, and he took control of the fight. He was actually even ahead on, I believe, two out of the three cards before the TKO stoppage in the seventh.
And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, just reading a lot of the we're talking with my friend Derek X. Of course, Derek joins us all the time talking boxing. We're going to talk about Jose Ramirez in just a second. If I'm not mistaken, in a lot of the pre-fight analyses that I read, there were a lot of pretty well-known analysts and former boxers who were saying, don't go to sleep on this guy. If you go to sleep on him, he'll put you to sleep.
And that's 100% correct, and that's exactly what happened. Joshua in the seventh round gets knocked down two more times. You know, I thought Andy had a chance. Now, did I think he was going to knock Joshua down four times? No. Joshua was a huge man. He held three belts. He was undefeated. He is the world champion. And if you look at the seventh round, Joshua, his mind said, yes, I'm ready to go. But he had spit his mouthpiece out when he was on the ground. His body was saying no. The ref saved him as well as he should have. That's their job in there. He was not physically able to continue. In the seventh round, as physically fit as he was, he wasn't ready to continue. Andy Ruiz beat him down.
You and I didn't get a chance to talk before this fight. How did you see this fight going into it?
Honestly, my overall opinion was that Andy had a shot, especially if he could get inside the jab and work the body. But Andy had never been knocked down before, and I really wasn't sure if he had the power to knock down Joshua. So honestly, I figured it would probably go to a decision. It would probably go the full length, and when you have the belts, you have to do something astronomical to have the belts taken from you. So I kind of thought maybe it would go to a split decision and Joshua would keep his belts.
All right, you tipped me off on this a little earlier, a comment about Andy. So I'm gonna frame it in a way to let you run with this. And I'm not really trying to be flippant, but it is what it is. When you look at Andy, you don't see this chiseled fighter, as you see with most guys. It gets less as you get to heavyweights.
Correct.
Although back in the day, you know, Muhammad Ali looked great. Mm-hmm. Joe Frazier looked great. Those guys looked great. But even they, you started to see it change just a little bit. But when you look at Andy, you don't see somebody who at least seems like he spent a lot of time worried about what he's eating. or trying to craft a body that you know that looks like a fighter, and yet that had nothing to do with his skills. Are there going to be boxers out there thinking, well, why am I wasting my time in the gym? As long as I can punch, as long as I've got a good strategy, as long as I've got good feet, I'm okay here.
In some aspects you are, but you also have to have that innate skill that Andy has to get inside people and hurt somebody when you punch them.
Right.
You know, Teddy Atlas said on ESPN that Andy Ruiz just ruined 100 years of physical fitness.
And of course he would say that.
He would say it, but he's been around the game
yes,
long
he
enough.
Has.
He can say that. But it's now, instead of questioning, you know, giving Ruiz credit, some people are questioning Joshua's heart, his talent in there. And to his credit, Joshua's just saying, I got beat. I didn't have anxiety before the fight. I didn't overlook him. I got beat. Enjoy your belts for the next 6 months, Andy. I'm coming to take them back. Now, I don't know if he will, because sometimes you can mentally get beat down, and Joshua may be at that point, because he's still got to wonder, this guy did this to me last time. He knocked me down 4 times. He outpunched me. Is it going to happen again? So I think Andy Ruiz is in Joshua's head.
I saw a comparison that was lining up the way he is able to beat guys, go after guys, a comparison to him and Manny Pacquiao. You buy into that?
I don't know if I'd buy into it because of the styles. Manny moves a lot more.
Clearly,
You know, you're talking the difference between orthodox and southpaw, too. So I believe there's different styles in it. I don't agree with that comparison.
By the way, you know, you're a man of hats. We always tell folks that, you know, you normally have got the X
on
your hat. Today, you have you look resplendent in your royal blue Bulldog's hat. You got the Bulldog logo on it. I'm just going to say, for people listening right now, the Bulldog on Derek's hat is almost the size of a Bulldog. That is the largest Bulldog logo I have ever seen. It's massive. I didn't know they made that hat.
Yes, sir.
Wow. All right. Yes, that's impressive. You wear it well. I want to progress over to Jose Ramirez.
Yes, sir.
And I was unaware of this, and you made me aware of it, that we're going to have a unification bout.
Yes, sir.
And it's going to be with Maurice Hooker.
Yes.
And there's a lot to talk about with this, because you have a guy who looks like, and I mean this in the most positive sense, a real bad dude. Maurice Hooker, 26-0-3, I believe.
Yes.
With 17 knockouts.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who is going to be fighting. This fight's going to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area?
Yes, sir, in Arlington.
In Arlington, mm-hmm. And that is home turf for him, is it not?
It absolutely is.
Okay, so you have a guy who is ranked, what, fourth in the world?
Yes, he is.
And Jose is ranked third.
Correct.
You have two belt holders. You have two guys who are technically outstanding in the ring. They're both smart fighters. Correct mm-hmm. me if anything I say is wrong. They're both smart fighters. They both pack a lot of punch. You know, when they hit you, if they hit you right, they're not going to beat themselves.
No.
And all of this in play, and now Jose is going to have to go and win on somebody else's turf. And it's a little different than when he went to New York with was it Mike Reed?
Iman.
Excuse me, Iman.
Yes.
Yeah, Mike Reed was here.
Yes.
Take me through this.
Well, you're looking at a couple of fighters that actually, in some aspects, parallel each other. They turn pro within 3 months of each other. Their records are similar. Their knockouts are similar. Their styles are somewhat similar. Maurice Hooker has been a little bit more of the underdog. If you look at Jose's last three fights, his last three opponents, total records are 78-2. No slouches. Maurice Hooker's last three opponents, 82-0. And Jose was slightly favored in each of these fights. Where he had the biggest odds and the biggest favor was the fight that didn't happen, and that was with Danny O'Connor. Otherwise, Jose's been anywhere from, you know, a minus 150 to a minus 250. Not huge odds for Vegas. Maurice Hooker has not been favored. He was not favored against Terry Flanagan. He was not favored against Saucedo. He won the belt on Flanagan, and he knocked Saucedo out. Saucedo is a brawler. This guy is kind of the true underdog, even though he holds a belt now. There are certain aspects to this fight that people really are going to have to look at, especially in the future tense of what could happen. You mentioned the rankings. Well, Regis Progray and Josh Taylor are in the WBSS series for the light welterweights. So there is a potential for a complete unification after these next two fights.
And I, it's interesting to me that, that when he beat Flanagan, Flanagan's a British fighter.
33-0.
And he goes there, and he beats him on his home home turf. It's impressive that, you know, you said they parallel each other, and they really do. I mean, because Iman was he not from New York? Was he
yes,
from Boston?
He was from
New York?
That
okay.
Area.
So, you know, going into the Garden, you know, I know that Jose had fans there, but he still, you know, showed that he could go and win somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I've talked with you a lot. I've always wondered how much of the emotional factor of a fight plays into it. You know, we watch when Fresno State had to go up and win at Boise State in the Mountain West Championship game. You watch a team that's playing on a neutral court, and sometimes they'll say, yeah, they beat them there, but if they play them at home, it's going to be a different story. How much is it going to come into play that Jose is going to be going to his turf, and it's really going to be his turf?
Jose is going to use it to his advantage. He's going to feel he's the underdog role. He's already compared it to his Iman fight, where he's going on to somebody else's turf. He's the underdog. They're all going to be cheering for the other guy. Iman was a bigger fighter. So is Hooker. Hooker's an inch taller. Where he's got a distinct advantage is in reach. He almost has 7.5 inches more in reach.
Hooker does.
Hooker
yeah.
does, yes. So Jose is going to say, I'm the underdog. You know, pressure's off of me. I don't have to, you know, cater to a fight that's being held in my hometown and do some of the extra things behind the scene as well as training. And along with that, let's back up for a second here. Let's really give Jose the credit for his last fight. He, in my mind, actually fought two fighters, or he was fighting two fights at one time. Zepeda, who was, you know, 30-1 at the time, very talented fighter, and was coachable. And where that came into play is Jose's ex-coach, Freddie Roach, who had been with him for years, who knows Jose in and out, was coaching Zepeda.
Right.
So not only did Jose have to beat Zepeda, he had to beat Freddie Roach.
He's beaten the guy. He's not only beaten the guy in the ring, he's beaten the guy outside the ring who's got the playbook.
And if you watched the first two rounds, you knew it, because he kept moving to the right outside of Jose's lead foot for the first two rounds. Jose would have to keep setting up. Give Robert Garcia credit. He told Jose what to do to offset that, and that's what you saw from the third rounds on. But, yes, the coaching was there. You could see Zepeda knew what Jose was going to do and
yeah.
still couldn't stop.
I remember you made those points really well the first time around. I want to keep you another segment, of course,
yes,
and I want to talk about this fight. When is the date on this fight?
July 27th.
Okay, coming up.
Yes,
it's not far, about 6 weeks or so,
yes.
six, 7 weeks. I want to talk about this fight from the standpoint of if Jose wins, what happens next? And if Jose loses, what happens next? We'll talk more with Derek X coming up. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel program right now on 940 ESPN.
Talking with my man Derek X. Looking ahead to Maurice Hooker and Jose Ramirez. Unification title bout, July 27th. At the College Park Center on the campus of UT Arlington, which is not far from where the Texas Rangers play baseball, where the Dallas Cowboys play football. And that, of course, is the team of Derek X. We won't hold that against him. Let's look at this from the standpoint of Jose, our guy here in the Central Valley. What does a fight like this do for him and his career moving forward? And it's a similar question that I've asked before with you, with the different fights with Orozco, with Reed, with Iman.
And Zepeda,
yeah. If he wins this fight down there, what would be reasonable to assume is next for Jose Ramirez?
Well, let's take this back a step. I remember being with Jose. We were at the pond in Anaheim watching some fights down there. And it was when he was being courted by both Golden Boy and Top Rank, or I should say when his promoter Rick Remigian, was getting them to negotiate against each other. And we're sitting 10, 15 feet from Don King, from Manny Pacquiao was there, Golden Boy Productions was there, a lot of heavy hitters. Jose's focus was on the fight. He watched the fight. So I started picking his mind about, okay, this happened this round, what would you do? And he said, I'd do this, this, and this. And that's exactly what the fighter in charge was doing. He did it. He said, my goal is to win a belt and then unify. Before he even turned pro, Jose is reaching those dreams. Now, Hooker is saying, I'm a dream killer. So, you know, this is going to be a quite an intense fight. This is what Jose always wanted. And let's keep in mind, too, that Jose kind of gave Rick orders that I want this fight. And Rick had to give some concessions, especially for his, from his own mind, because he does everything he can to bring stuff here to make it beneficial for Jose. They had to be some concessions because this went cross-platform. You're talking Top Rank versus, you know, Matchroom Boxing, DAZN versus ESPN. They had to go cross-platform to agree to this fight. So there were a lot of concessions for this fight for the sole reason of this, a unification fight that will propel the winner to a chance for a complete unification against another scheduled fight of Regis Progre, ranked number one, and Josh Taylor, ranked number two in this division, that is a fight that's scheduled, but they're still looking for a location for that one.
I get the idea, because here in the Central Valley, it would be very easy to, and it, you could do this in any sport, whether it's a team sport or an individual sport. I get the idea that sometimes we get insulated here, that we forget not everybody loves Jose Ramirez the way the Central Valley does. There are a lot of people out there. I've seen them on social media. I've heard from some saying, I think that Jose is overrated. I don't, but I think he's overrated. I think that it's just going to take one guy to finally bring this guy down. And I've got to believe that is, and obviously that's a motivator for him because he hears it.
He hears it all the time.
Yeah.
And he usually doesn't get into it too much on social media with other boxers and their BS. Regis is famous for that, calling individuals out.
But Regis Progre?
Yes.
Yeah.
And you are correct in that aspect, though, that for quite a while outside California, even though he was a 2012 Olympian and, you know, has a highly decorated amateur career, not a lot of people outside California really knew who he was. So give Meridian credit then for taking him to New York, for doing fights in Texas to try and get his name out there a little bit more. It was the long game for Jose since day one. Not something where he came out and was just going to, you know, knock everybody out, be a Lomachenko, and all of a sudden have three belts in your first 13 fights. He came out, it was the long game for him, and it's played out perfectly. It's just one more step for Jose, one more step. In Jose's mind, this is a great opportunity, but this is what was planned for him.
So to go back to the original question going into the pause and revisiting with Derek X, if he wins, what would it be, looking at a Regis Progre or a Josh Taylor?
Yes. If he wins, then you're looking that Jose is going to have his WBC belt. He's going to have Maurice Hooker's WBO belt. The other fight that's it's scheduled, but they're still looking for places, and the WBSS is Regis Progre against Josh Taylor. Regis just won the WBA belt, and he also had the interim WBC belt. Josh Taylor has the IBF belt. So the winner of that fight is going to have two belts.
I've said this to you before, and everybody listening who are day-in, day-out boxing fans, they don't have the issue with this that I do. I'm guessing here. The thing about boxing that drives me nuts are the amount of belts. Because it just seems like it's another reason to water down a sport, just like when there are more teams that are added. Big rosters are made bigger. You know, you look at the NFL, what it was when there were less teams. Back in the day. But listen, I think we can all agree that there were teams 25 years ago that were probably better of top to bottom, 53 guys, than a lot of the teams today, simply because there's just more teams, more players, and a lot of those guys today couldn't have made those teams then. People can debate that. That's fine. I just get confused with all with the endless amount of belts.
And you kind of have to put those to the side unless it's a title fight, because it does get confusing. You have your interim belts, your silver belts, your diamond belts. And I love the WBC, but I got to shake my head at them. They're one of the ones that create a lot of these belts. Now, I can see for, like, the Cinco de Mayo fight with Canelo, where you add in a special belt that has significance because of the day and the holiday, but it's not something that you really fight to defend, you know, when it comes up. It's not something that's really up for grabs at the next fight. So I really have a tendency to agree with you. Coach Pete and I have talked about this quite a bit, that enough with the belts, you know. And some of that you have to give with the sanctioning bodies, too, because there are different rules, different regulations, and you could be a top five fighter, but if you haven't paid the IBF to be part of their system, you're not in their top five.
Last thing for you. Let's flip the scenario.
Yes.
What if Jose loses?
It's a regroup at that time. I don't think it would be devastating, because Hooker's no joke. You know, he is a little bit taller. He has 7.5 inches more reach. He was not favored against Flanagan. He was not favored against Saucedo. This guy is a fighter. You know, yes, you and I were talking off air. There's a little bit of hesitation in it. But once you reach fights of this level, hesitation in prognostication is good, because that means a lot of people are thinking this is going to be a great fight. He will regroup if for some reason that unfortunately happens. And there's probably already a plan in place, because these people plan a lot in the future. When it hit that, oh, the negotiating stage of this fight is just coming out, I talked or texted with Jose's promoter. And he's like, no, this has been going on for almost 8 weeks. So there's a lot of planning and a lot of contingency plans made. Right now, Jose is not focusing on the downside of it.
You went a little Ali there for a second. I got hesitation for your prognostication for the unification.
There you go.
He is Derek X, and you will definitely be back in here. We'll get you back in here right before the fight,
yes,
to
sir.
Talk about it, and then we'll talk about the post-fight win, lose, or draw.
Yes, sir.
Always a pleasure to see you, my friend.
Thank you.
All right. He is Derek X, and he is the official boxing expert for the CGP. We always appreciate him coming in. Coming up, we're going to switch from boxing to movies. Nick Shager, Daily Beast Variety, Yahoo Movies, Esquire. He is next. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
Variety, Daily Beast, Esquire, Yahoo Movies. We only go for the A-list film critics on this program, and there's only one. And his name is Nick Shager, and he joins me right now, as he always does every Friday. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Happy Friday, Christopher.
Boy, indeed, indeed. Happy Friday. Of course, we are keeping our eyes 175 miles west-northwest to Oracle Arena. Lots of folks saying it's going to be the final game in Oracle. I am not one of them. You and I will talk about that in a moment. I'm looking forward to getting the view from Mr. Celtics fan. This weekend has an interesting grouping of films or series. Let's start with Dark Phoenix. I've liked some of the X-Men films. Others I have not. Is this going to be the final project, or is it going to be picked up by somebody else?
Well, as you said, yeah, there have been a lot of X-Men movies over the last 20 years now, just about 19 years, I guess. And this is not only going to be the last one from Fox Studios, but they're actually even advertising it as such. So they're owning up to the fact that this is really the culmination of the last 19 years. That doesn't mean we'll be done with X-Men movies. Fox has been purchased by Disney, and since Disney owns Marvel, Marvel undoubtedly is going to, in the future here, integrate the X-Men into the larger Marvel Cinematic Universe, probably with a new cast and a whole new sort of, you know, storyline that will be totally divorced from this. So this is really the end of what everyone's been watching, and I have to admit, it's a big-time disappointment. It is not the way they wanted to go out. Dark Phoenix is actually it's a film that the X-Men movies have the most convoluted timeline in the history of movies. And this movie is actually the same, is based on the same comic book storyline, the Dark Phoenix saga, that was already adapted back in 2006 for the third X-Men movie, X-Men The Last Stand. That movie was written by a guy named Simon Kinberg, who's since gone on to write a lot of the other X-Men movies. And Kinberg has now written this movie as well. So he's adapting the same story a second time, and he directs it. It's about basically one of the X-Men, Jean Grey, who's a telepath. She gets this ungodly sort of cosmic power and goes a bit evil, and the X-Men have to stop her. This movie, though, is just, especially in light of Avengers Endgame and a lot of the other Marvel movies, it just looks second rate. I can't get over the fact that, you know, a lot of fine actors are in it, a lot of good talent is in it, but the movies actually look so much worse than the Marvel movies. They look so amateurish. The costumes look sort of silly. The special effects are definitely subpar. And so as a result, I just think people are going to, excuse me while we have a helicopter go overhead here. Maybe it's the X-Men coming to get me. I just think people are going to find it to be really, really mediocre. And that's too bad because I'm someone who's liked the X-Men. I grew up reading the comics. I've liked some of the movies, but they need to get this back to Marvel to really reboot it. And also, in my opinion, you know, to get Wolverine back in it. Wolverine, who's played by Hugh Jackman so well, they need a new Wolverine because he's the biggest draw. And without him, it just feels very small.
Well, you said something early on that I made a note of, and you said that it just, you know, it just doesn't look good. And you amplified on that a little bit. When you look at the amount of time that they have that goes into the preparation, not only the writing, the rewriting, and so on, first draft, second draft, third draft, and so on, and then you get these talented people involved with the special effects, how do they come up with a product that ends up not looking right, not feeling right, and just not being very good?
Well, you know, it really does, I think, start from the top down. You know, Marvel has not only been successful at interweaving all of these stories, but they've been very good about creating a unified look for the films, both in terms of not just costuming and coloring and lighting, but also in terms of the style of action, the way they put the films together. And they've been so successful at doing that, that it's sort of thrown into sharp relief when other people can't do it. And here, I just think there is a lack of not only vision from the top, but then, you know, down a notch or two. I think the effects houses they're working with don't do as good a job. I think they rely on certain styles of practical effects that look outdated in relation to other films. I was actually watching the previous X-Men movie a couple of nights ago on cable, X-Men Apocalypse, and you could just see that the stunt work that was being done there was just subpar. And it, to some extent, it's a matter of hiring the right people who really can do this stuff in a cutting-edge way. And the truth is, you know, Fox can do it, too, because they also make the Deadpool movies, which are related to the X-Men movies. And those look, you know, A-list, even at sort of a B-grade budget. They look much better than the X-Men movies. So I think it's time to scrap this. I love the X-Men. I'm looking forward to them getting a new life elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, I mean, we all know, right, whether it's a film series or whether it's a TV series, we all know when either they've hit the apex or they've gone well past it and it's time to move on.
It's true, yeah. Some things just have run their course and then we need a little bit of time away from this and then come back to it with fresh eyes and fresh talent, and you know, that's usually the best way to go about it.
Yeah, I think the movie industry can take their cue from sports teams a lot of times when somebody hangs on a little too long, or boxers. We're talking with Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Secret Life of Pets 2. You have Louis C.K. being replaced by Patton Oswalt. I like Patton Oswalt's voice better than I like him as an actor, and so I think he'll probably come in nicely here. Is this going to be a sequel that we like, or is it going to be one that you will also say, you know what, let's move on?
You know, I think that the Secret Life of Pets franchise, which is now a franchise because we have a second one here, has turned out to be better than I originally expected. The first film is a perfectly fun, friendly, pleasant enough time. It's amusing enough. It doesn't reinvent the wheel. The truth is, you know, the story was about the secret life of your pets. When you go out, you know, after, you know, when you go to work and your pets are left home alone, they actually have lives of their own. And that was what the movie showed. And it was basically, in that regard, a sort of animal version of Toy Story, where the toys come alive when you're not around. Here, we're in very similar territory. The story is actually sort of split into three. The main story involves Max, the dog, who's, as you said, now voiced by Patton Oswalt, who goes off to a farm to be sort of rehabilitated because he's so worked up over trying to protect his owner's new baby. He's become very protective, and he's very worried about the kid getting hurt in every sort of respect. And so in that regard, the film is also, again, sort of a knockoff of Pixar films, except instead of Toy Story, this time we also have some Finding Nemo thrown in, because it's about a parental figure learning to sort of let their child sort of, you know, take some bumps and bruises and experience life, and maybe that's the best way to go about things rather than, you know, to encase them in a protective shell or something. But I think the film, again, is not the most original film in the world, but it's got a lot of personality. It's got a lot of humor. It's got Kevin Hart. He plays Snowball, the crazy bunny who's sort of the breakout star of the series here. He wants to be a superhero. It's fun, but I don't think it's going to knock anyone's socks off. I think it's really going to be a good choice for parents before Toy Story 4 comes out in a few weeks and totally blows everything out of the water in terms of child films. But, you know, in the meantime, it more than does the job.
A couple of things about it. I saw Eric Stonestreet's voices in it. He's from Modern Family, right?
He is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's got a big cast, yeah.
Whenever a film like this comes out and it's not Pixar, is there already an uphill battle in place? Because Pixar has sort of cornered the market on these types of films. And not to say that other studios can't do them, but it just seems that when Pixar does them, they do them much better.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we're still at the point, even whatever it is, since Toy Story was, I think, 1995, so we're 24 years into the Pixar run, and despite the other animation houses doing lots of great work, DreamWorks does great work, Fox does great work, Blue Sky Studios does really good stuff, Pixar is still the gold standard, and a lot of these films, as you know, I was saying with this franchise, are really still trying to live up to Pixar, if not sort of ape them a little bit. And so here, as I said, I think people are going to like it. I certainly, kids who like the first movie are going to like the second one. It's got a bit of meat on its bones, so to speak. So there's something there to enjoy, but yeah, Toy Story 4 is still going to be the big draw. I think it's the big draw for me. I think it's going to be the big draw for lots of people of various ages. And yeah, Pixar, until they're dethroned, they're still the champ.
Well, and you mentioned Toy Story 4 coming out soon, and I just, that's one series that I've never gotten tired of. I just feel like, yeah, there's been, you know, different ones. The original is still my favorite, but they've all managed in one way or another to be very creative, have fun, you know, fun writing, fun little characters, and I don't know, it just seems like they've not lost the charm yet.
No, I mean, we'll get a chance to talk about Toy Story 4 in a couple of weeks, but there's no doubt. I mean, we're talking about a movie here that's the fourth movie in a franchise that began 24 years ago or 24 years ago, and it's still going to be the big animated movie of the summer, and everyone's looking forward to it because they haven't hit a wrong note yet. Even Toy Story 3, which I think is the worst of them, quote unquote, is great and makes everybody I know cry. So, you know, they've just got the magic touch, and hopefully they'll continue.
No doubt. We are talking with Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Esquire, and Yahoo Movies. Let's talk about killer ratings. This is it's Netflix. What do you think it is? It's true crime. is this going to be yet another bonanza for Netflix?
As far as I'm concerned, it is. I actually was a little bit late to the Killer Ratings party. Killer Ratings premiered late last week, and it showed up with no fanfare. So when I heard about it this week, I was a little surprised that it was already on the service. So I spent a day watching the whole thing, and I wrote up a big piece for the Daily Beast. And anyone who reads that piece will know that I absolutely loved the show. It is a 7-part true crime series. And, you know, we've had a million true crime series at this point, and so you can naturally expect that the show is going to be sort of wild and unexpected and sort of perplexing. But this story, which I had knew nothing about, is really a cut above. It's about a Brazilian television show host. He hosted a show called Canal Livre, I believe, and it was a show that was about tracking down the drug traffickers and the criminals in his northern Brazilian hometown. And it was sort of like Cops, but it was much wilder. He'd be in the studio saying that, you know, drug dealers should get a bullet in the head, and he had people operating puppets. It was sort of a comedy thing. It was wild. And then there was all this on-the-street stuff where they were chasing criminals and coming upon murder scenes, and it was a wild show, and it propelled him to a political career because he was such a crusader for the working class people, and he was, you know, fighting for their rights to have, you know, an opportunity to live free of crime and free of violence. And so he wound up becoming nominated to the state assembly, and he was really on the fast track to real, you know, Brazilian political power. And then it came out that maybe he was actually a drug kingpin himself, and he was staging these murders, not staging them fakely. I mean, he was actually orchestrating them so that he could get better ratings on his television show. And so that was the reason his camera crews always showed up first to the crime scenes. They always knew exactly where to go. And it just gets wilder from there because, of course, that is just the most bonkers situation you've ever imagined, that they find these dead bodies and he actually had ordered them to be killed so that his camera people could get there. It gets wilder. There's all sorts of stuff about political corruption and conspiracies because he, of course, proclaims his innocence. If you're looking for something that will really make your jaw drop because you can't believe it's even real, Killer Ratings is the show for you. It is consistently gripping. And, I recommend also not reading up on it beforehand because you don't want there are a lot of things that happen, and having them spoiled would definitely ruin some of the fun.
And, you know, there, as you were explaining this, it sounds fascinating. It seems to have an element of Pablo Escobar to it, does it not?
It does. In fact, you get the sense that this is very much related to not only Escobar and all that sort of stuff, but to Narcos itself.
Yes.
The opening credit sequence reminded me of Netflix's Narcos. There really was a drug problem, a drug trafficking problem there, and these cartels and these gangsters were really operating in a lawless fashion. I mean, it was a scary place and a scary time when this was happening in the 90s and early 2000s. And the fact that this guy might have been covertly operating as this champion of the people when he was really the villain he was actually pretending to be going after is almost too much to believe. And as I said, I won't ruin any of the surprises because there's a lot that goes on in 7 episodes, but it really is a unique entry in the true crime genre.
That sounds great. And we're talking with Nick Shager, our elite film mind, HBO documentary premiering tonight, The Cold Blue. You know, it's on World War II, and I'm going to have you roll this out. But it's interesting to me that there's this curious and yet fascinating dichotomy when we talk about World War II documentaries, that even though a film or a documentary is essentially there's almost a romantic quality to it. We're looking at the greatest generation. We're looking at the greatest victory of the Allies. You know, sometimes we forget, because we're watching the beauty of a documentary, how many people lost their lives. But I think the best documentaries are the ones that don't shy away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And The Cold Blue is a film that I think really does straddle that line, because it's a documentary that's actually sort of an archival work, like some of the other movies we've had recently, like Apollo 11. It is culled almost exclusively, or let's say largely, from old footage that was shot by one of the great Hollywood directors of all time, William Wyler, who in 1943 went to war with the U.S. He joined up with the 8th Air Force Battalion, and he shot footage. Him and three other cinematographers shot footage in the planes with the Air Force, flying missions, and it was for a documentary he made called The Memphis Belle. But it turned out that there was a lot of outtakes, and the footage was restored now for this documentary, The Cold Blue, and it is some of the most beautiful color footage of World War II you've ever seen. I mean, they are in the planes while they're being shot at, and it's wild. And what makes the documentary so much better than just being this beautiful, you know, panorama of this stuff is that they've also interviewed 8 or 9 veterans from the 8th Air Force who speak over the footage and sort of narrate their experiences. And that really brings it home in a much bigger, sort of more pointed way. You really get a feel for what the experience was like being in one of those planes and being in the service and fighting the war, and what their opinions were of the war, how they coped with this sort of stuff, the losses they suffered, the trauma they suffered, also the camaraderie they had. It really is a very, very stirring film in that regard. And the movie's only about 75, 80 minutes long, so it doesn't overstay its welcome. But, you know, people who are interested in World War II or interested in just getting a larger sense of history, especially now because it's just been the 75th anniversary of D-Day, which this is timed to, you really couldn't do a lot better than this documentary. It really did move me in a surprising way.
You know, you're mentioning this. It's fascinated me, and as I'm listening to it, I'm thinking about when I was in Fargo. There was an air show, and there's air shows all over the country. But I had the opportunity of a lifetime to go up in a B-25, and it was striking to me for two reasons. One, how truly cramped those bombers were. I mean, from the right gunner or the left gunner or the bombardier position to the back of the plane, to the rear gunner, you literally, to get in, you had to crawl. You couldn't stand up. You had to crawl in through the fuselage. And the other, I used to wonder why sometimes when I would see footage, Nick, of these guys wearing headphones, it's so loud. It's loud beyond belief when you are in these old planes. And any of our great veterans who are listening right now, they know exactly what I'm talking about. My dad flew in B-29s, and he used to tell me in Korea, and he told me what that was like. So I'm always fascinated to look at a documentary like this because, you know, you can pick up little details and things that you didn't know, and you think that you knew. We like to think that we know a lot about our history, but then you watch a documentary like this and you realize, wow, maybe there's a lot I didn't know.
Yeah, it really is an eye-opening experience, and this film is the kind of film that gives you a really incisive, you know, up close and personal look at a very particular facet of an enormous war that had a million facets. And here, yeah, this is all about B-17s, and you do get a real sense, as you're talking about the cramped nature of it. One of the most fascinating things was how they talked about how cold it was, that apparently the B-17s, for example, were not heated. And so you would go up in the air and you'd be up 20,000 some odd feet, and it would be as much as 65 below. And the guys would be freezing. And one guy actually gets an anecdote about how he knew a guy who fell asleep with his hand against the window and had to have his fingers amputated because he got frostbite immediately. Geez. So, I mean, it was really a harrowing, you know, traumatic ordeal in a number of different ways, not just the Germans were trying to shoot you down from the sky and from the ground. But, you know, the conditions were a nightmare. It's a fascinating movie.
No, that's crazy. We got 10 seconds left. Warriors or Raptors?
I'm still going with the Warriors. I still think they're going to come back here. I think Clay's going to give them a boost.
I'm with you. He is Nick Shager, and he is the best. Nick, great stuff as always. We'll talk next week, my friend.
Looking forward to it. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. One more thing is next. This is the CGP. One more thing today is longtime CGP listener, my man Ray. I had a chance to see him last night. Ray is, again, a very loyal listener. He's a good friend, but he's also a cancer survivor. And he was talking about how much he enjoys the show. Ray, I just want you to know how much I appreciate our friendship and appreciate that you listen and appreciate that you email, because ultimately we do this program for you. We'll see you on Monday, folks. Until then, you're on your own.